Part 1. Career Workshop Booking.
Good morning, University Careers Service. This is Emma speaking. How can I help you today?
Hi, Emma. I'm calling because I'd like to sign up for one of the career development workshops that are coming up. I saw the email about them last week.
Certainly. We have a few different workshops scheduled. Which one are you thinking of?
Well, I've been struggling with job applications recently, so I thought the one about CVs and cover letters might be useful.
That sounds like our effective job applications workshop. It's actually broader than just CVs and cover letters. It also covers how to tailor applications, addressing selection criteria, and even some tips for online applications. The CV and cover letter workshop is a shorter session we run separately.
Oh, I see. I didn't realize there were two different ones. The effective job application sounds more comprehensive, so I'll go for that.
Excellent choice. It's one of our most popular workshops. Now, let me get your details so I can register you. Could I start with your full name, please?
Yes, it's Alex Johnson.
Is that Johnson with an 8 or without?
With an AS. Actually, can I just spell it for you? It's J-O-H-N-S-O-N.
J-O-H-N-S-O-N. Perfect. Thank you. And are you a current student or an alumnus?
I'm an alumnus, graduated last year, but I received an email saying alumni are welcome to attend these sessions.
That's right. We do open them to recent graduates as well. Could I take your contact number? I'll put it on the booking just in case we need to reach you.
Sure, it's 1234-987,654.
Let me just read that back. 01234987654. Is that correct?
Oh, actually, the last digit should be 3, not 4. My mistake. So the full number is 1234-987,653.
Great. I've updated that to end in 3. And do you have an email you'd like us to use? It's useful for sending out reminders and any materials after the workshop.
I do. It's alex.johnson@email.com. That's fine for emails. But if you need to get hold of me quickly, a phone call works better.
Noted. Now, regarding the workshop, we have it running on a few dates in March. There's the 15th, 6th, and 22nd. Which one works for you?
My first choice was the 15th because it's earlier, but when I looked online earlier, it seemed fully booked.
Let me check. Yes, unfortunately, the 15th is completely full. There's still availability on the 16th, though. That's the Friday.
Hang on, I think the 16th is the day I have a doctor's appointment in the morning. Is it a morning workshop?
It runs from 10 a.m. to 1 p.m. on all dates, so if you have a morning appointment, that might not work. The 22nd is the other option. That's a Thursday and still has plenty of spaces.
Okay, I could do the 22nd. That should be fine.
Excellent. I'll book you in for the 22nd of March, 10 a.m. to 1 p.m. Now, do you know where it's held?
I assumed it was in the student center. Most of the careers events are there.
Yes, it's in the student center. The room is 4C. Oh, hold on. I've just been given an update. The room has been changed to 4B, which is just across the hall. So that's room 4B.
Okay, 4B. I'll make a note.
In terms of cost, the workshop is free. We used to charge a small fee, and sometimes we ask for a refundable deposit for materials. But this semester, the university is covering all costs, so it's completely free for you.
That's brilliant. I was worried there might be a charge.
No, nothing at all. And what you need to bring, it's really important that you bring a printed copy of your CV with you. The workshop involves a lot of hands-on work, where you'll be analysing and improving your own CV. If you absolutely don't have a CV yet, you can bring a job description you're targeting, but having your CV is ideal because you'll get more out of the session.
I do have a CV, though it's probably not very good. I'll bring it along.
Don't worry. That's exactly what the workshop is for. Oh, and I should mention, the session is run by Mrs. Thompson, who's one of our most experienced careers advisors. She used to work in recruitment, so she really knows what employers are looking for.
That's reassuring. What if something comes up and I can't make it on the day?
Just let's know as soon as possible, ideally at least 24 hours in advance. That way, we can give your spot to someone on the waiting list. You can call this number again or email, but if it's last minute, a phone call is best.
Perfect. I'll keep that in mind. Is there anything else I need to know?
I think that's everything. Just come to room 4B Student Center at 10 a.m. on the 22nd with your CV. We'll send a confirmation email with all these details as well.
Oh, one more thing. Is there parking available near the Student Center? I'll be driving in.
Yes, there's a visitor car park just behind the building. It does fill up quickly, though, so I'd recommend arriving a bit early. Alternatively, you can use the park and ride, which is often easier.
All right, I'll keep that in mind.
And just a note, if you're running late on the day, it's fine to join after the start, but you might miss the initial warm-up activity.
Hopefully I won't be late, but that's good to know.
Exactly. Just try to be there by 10:15 if you can to get the most out of it.
Thanks again, Emma.
You're welcome. Good luck with the job applications, and we'll see you then.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
That's the end of part one. Part two, Campus Careers Fair.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to the annual University Careers Fair. I'm Sarah, the Student Union Events Coordinator, and I'll be here to guide you through everything you need to know about today's event. I know many of you have been looking forward to this, so let's get straight into it. First of all, a few important changes from what you might have seen in the earlier publicity. The fair is taking place in the Grand Hall and not the main building as originally planned. The Grand Hall is the large building directly behind the library. You can't miss it. If you're coming from the campus entrance, it's just a short walk past the fountain. The entrance we're using today is on the west side, not the main entrance. So follow the signs that say Careers Fair, West Entrance. When you come in, you'll find the registration desk immediately in the foyer. Even if you've already registered online, please stop there to pick up your name badge and the fair program, which includes a map and list of all the employers. The program is crucial because we've had some last-minute changes to stand locations. So, the layout of the Grand Hall, it's a large rectangular space. Picture it. The entrance is at one end, and at the opposite end is the stage. As soon as you walk in, to your right, you'll see the refreshment area where we're serving free tea, coffee, and soft drinks throughout the day. Just past that, on the right wall, is a series of stands from our sponsors. These are mostly recruitment agencies who can give you tips on the job market. On the left side as you enter, that's where the information desk is located. If you have any questions during the day, the volunteers there can help. Now, the employer stands are organized by industry sector. Along the left side, walking from the entrance toward the stage, you'll first encounter the retail and hospitality companies. Then further down, you get to the creative industries, media, design, advertising. At the very back left corner, right before the stage, is the technology zone, where you'll find IT companies, software developers, and so on. On the right side, starting from the entrance, we have financial services and banking in the first section, then engineering and manufacturing further back. In the back right corner, there is a designated quiet area for private conversations with employers. This is also where the CV clinic is located. I want to highlight this, the CV clinic has been moved. Initially, it was supposed to be at stand 15, but that's now occupied by a logistics company. The CV clinic is now at stand 22, right at the back right corner next to the quiet area. So if you're looking to have your CV reviewed by a professional, go to stand 22. Also, there's a career guidance stand, that's stand number 5, which is on the left, not far from the entrance. just past the information desk. Here you can speak to careers advisors about your long-term plans, further study, or if you're unsure what direction to take. They're offering 15-minute drop-in sessions. Now, regarding timings, there's been an important update. The fair was publicized to run from 10 a.m. until 4 p.m. However, we've managed to extend the opening hours in the morning, but we're closing earlier. The new schedule is 9 a.m. to 3 p.m., so we start an hour earlier and finish an hour earlier. I know that might be a change for those of you who plan to come later. The doors open at 9 and we'll have a welcome speech from the Vice Chancellor at 9:30 on the stage. Also, please note that some specific services have their own schedules. The career guidance stand will only be available until 2 p.m. because the advisors need to leave for another appointment. The CV clinic will close at 2:30 and the refreshment area will shut at 2:30 as well. So come earlier rather than later if you want to take full advantage of everything. A couple of practical points. There are no cash machines inside the Grand Hall. So if you want to buy any careers publications or if you need cash, the nearest ATM is at the Students' Union Building, just a 2-minute walk away. Also, dress code. While this is a casual event, I'd recommend smart casual as first impressions count. And one more thing, we have a competition. If you collect stamps from 10 different employer stands, you can enter a draw to win a tablet. Stamps are in your program. For those of you in creative industries, Stand 12 is where you'll find a special portfolio review session. That's in the creative industries section on the left. And a new addition, the university's own career service has a stand right at the back near the stage, Stand 30, where they're promoting their mentoring scheme. Also, I should correct an error in the printed program. Some of you might have an earlier version where the engineering section was listed as being in the front right corner. That's incorrect. The engineering section is actually before the quiet area, so it's not at the very back. Just to clarify, on the right side, it's finance first, then engineering, then the quiet area and CB clinic at the back. So engineering is in the middle, not the back. And another change, the IT company's zone was going to have a robotic demonstration at 11 a.m., but that's been moved to 1 p.m. due to technical delays. So if you're interested, head there at 1 p.m. All right, I think that covers the main points. Enjoy the fair and make the most of it. If you have any questions, I'm here for the next few minutes.
That's the end of part two. Part 3. Workplace Research Discussion. Good afternoon, Tom. Lisa, come on in. I've looked at your project proposal and it's quite promising. How are things progressing with the research on workplace diversity in small enterprises?
Hi, Professor. We've made some headway, but honestly, we're a bit stuck on methodology. Yeah, I think we've got a clear topic, but we're disagreeing about how to collect the data.
That's common. Tell me what each of you thinks.
I started by interviewing HR managers at 3 local small businesses. The conversations were really rich. I got detailed insights into how they think about diversity. But Tom thinks that's not enough. Look, 3 interviews is anecdotal at best. To make any kind of valid conclusion, we need a larger sample. I propose we create an online survey and send it to at least 50 small businesses. That way we can quantify trends, like the percentage of companies with diversity training, and correlate that with outcomes. But a survey can't capture the nuance. People might not answer honestly, or they might interpret questions differently, and designing a good survey takes ages.
Okay, let's pause. Both approaches have merits. In fact, I'd encourage you to use a mixed methods design. Start with Lisa's interviews to identify key themes, then use those themes to develop a survey for a broader sample. That way, you get depth and breadth. What do you think?
I mean, that could work, but it does double the workload. And I'm not sure we have time. We're already a bit behind schedule.
Speaking of schedule, what's your current timeline?
We originally planned to complete data collection by last week, but we haven't even agreed on the method. The final submission is April 30th.
I see. Let's talk about division of labor. That might help. Tom, you're quite good with quantitative analysis, right? And Lisa, you took that qualitative methods module last term.
Yes, I enjoyed that.
So how about this, Lisa? You continue with a couple more interviews, say up to 5 total, and you transcribe and code them for themes. Tom, you use those themes to design a pilot survey, then we'll get it out to a larger group. Then you can handle the survey analysis. Do that sound fair?
I suppose. But I still need to do the literature review, and that's time-consuming.
Actually, I've got a suggestion there. There's a new review article by Chen and colleagues just published last month in the Journal of Business Ethics that summarizes the last 10 years of diversity research. It could save you a lot of reading. I can send you the reference.
That would help. I'm also worried about the survey design. I've never made one before.
Tom can take the lead on that, but you should both pilot it with a few friends to check for clarity. Now, about your analysis, your proposal mentioned looking at the relationship between diversity policies and staff turnover. Have you given thought to how you'll measure that?
Well, we were thinking of just asking whether they have a policy and what their turnover rate is, but Lisa thinks there's more to it. Right, because turnover could be affected by industry, location, size. If we don't control for those, our results will be meaningless.
Good point, Lisa. Tom, you'll need to include control variables in your survey, things like number of employees, sector, and maybe whether the business is family-owned. That will make your analysis more robust.
Okay, I can do that. But this is getting complicated.
Research is complicated, but you're learning. Now, I also want to see a clear plan for the write-up. Who's doing what?
I assumed I'd write the introduction and literature review.
Normally, yes. But given the mixed methods, it might be better if Tom writes the methodology section, since he'll be handling the quantitative part. And Lisa, you could write the qualitative findings and the discussion. But let's not set it in stone yet.
Actually, I'd prefer to write the discussion, because I'm interested in the implications. But I want to do the discussion too. We both can't.
All right. Why don't you split the discussion? Lisa, you interpret the interview findings, and Tom, you interpret the survey results. Then together, you write the conclusion, tying it all together.
That could work. Fine by me.
Now, about deadlines. I've had a word with the course administrator, and given that many groups are struggling, they're offering an automatic 1-week extension for anyone who submits a request. So the final deadline could move from April 30th to May 7th. But you would need to email the office by April 20th to request it. And you must still submit a draft to me by April 23rd so I can give feedback.
That's great news. A week makes a big difference.
It does, but don't squander it. I expect the draft to be substantial, especially the methodology and initial analysis. If I don't see enough progress, I won't support your extension.
We'll work hard. I think we have a plan now.
Good. Let's schedule another meeting in 2 weeks, on the 15th, to review your draft introduction and your interview transcripts. Tom, bring me a draft survey by then as well.
Sure. Thanks, Professor. Thanks very much.
You're welcome. Keep up the communication.
Actually, one of the interview participants said something interesting. They said their company doesn't have a diversity policy because they think it's not necessary. They just hire based on merit. But they're a very homogeneous team. See, that's exactly the kind of assumption our survey could challenge. Maybe companies without policies think they don't need them, but they might have higher turnover because they lack inclusion.
That's a great example. It shows why combining methods is powerful. Lisa, you can probe deeper in your next interviews about the reasons behind not having policies. Tom, you can design a survey question that captures the merit's belief. Then you can see if it correlates with diversity outcomes.
I'm still not convinced a survey can pick up on those subtleties.
It can if you design the questions carefully. Use Likert scales in open-ended questions. I can give you some sample questions from a previous study.
That'd be useful. And Professor, what statistical test do you recommend? I was thinking of using a t-test to compare turnover rates between companies with and without policies.
A t-test might be too simplistic, especially with multiple control variables. You'll likely need multiple regression. But that's advanced. I can walk you through it in our next meeting.
Okay, I'll read up on it.
Great. I'm glad we're making progress. Just remember, the key is to integrate both types of data. Let's catch up on the 15th then. That's the end of part 3. Part 4, Lifelong Learning and Career Resilience. Good morning, everyone. Today's lecture is on a topic that's increasingly relevant in our modern economy, lifelong learning and career resilience. As many of you prepare to enter or re-enter the workforce, you're likely aware that the days of a job for life are largely over. Instead, we're seeing a shift towards what's known as a protean career, one that's self-directed and shaped by the individual rather than the organization. So, what's driving this change? The primary cause is the rapid pace of technological advancement. Automation, artificial intelligence, and digitization are transforming industries at an unprecedented rate. For instance, consider the field of journalism. 20 years ago, print was king, but today, most news is consumed online, and journalists must be skilled in multimedia storytelling, data journalism, and social media management. This isn't an isolated case. From manufacturing to healthcare, technology is reshaping job roles. Another factor is globalization, which has increased competition and made it necessary for workers to adapt to international standards and practices. And finally, demographic shifts, such as an aging workforce and delayed retirement, mean that people are working longer and need to update their skills more frequently to stay relevant. So, the causes are clear: technological change, globalization, and demographic trends. Now, in response to these forces, the concept of career resilience has emerged. Career resilience isn't simply about keeping a job, it's about the capacity to navigate career transitions, overcome setbacks, and proactively manage one's professional development. It involves a set of behaviors and attitudes, including adaptability, continuous learning, and networking. Psychologists often break down career resilience into three components: self-awareness, adaptability, and social capital. Self-awareness helps you understand your strengths and weaknesses. Adaptability allows you to pivot when circumstances change, and social capital. Your network provides opportunities and support. Research has shown that individuals who engage in lifelong learning, that's the ongoing, self-motivated pursuit of knowledge for personal or professional reasons, are better equipped to demonstrate career resilience. Let me give you an example from a longitudinal study conducted by the Institute for Employment Studies. They tracked 2,000 workers over a decade and found that those who participated in formal training or self-directed learning at least once a year were 30% less likely to experience long-term unemployment. Moreover, they reported higher levels of job satisfaction and were more likely to be promoted. So, the effect seems to be a combination of improved employability and psychological empowerment. However, it's not just about taking courses. Lifelong learning can take many forms. It could be formal education, like a degree or certification, but also informal learning through online tutorials, reading industry publications, attending conferences, or even learning on the job. The key is a mindset of continuous improvement. In fact, some of the most resilient workers I've encountered are those who have a learning orientation. They view challenges as opportunities to grow rather than threats. This is supported by the work of psychologist Carol Dweck on growth mindset, though applied to careers. A meta-analysis by Brown and Hesketh in 2004 found that proactive learning behavior was the strongest predictor of career success, even after controlling for education and experience. Now, as promising as these findings sound, we must consider the limitations of the research. Much of the evidence linking lifelong learning to career outcomes comes from self-reported data. People might overstate their learning activities or their job success. Also, there's a selection bias. Those who are already motivated and career savvy are more likely to seek out learning opportunities, so it's not clear whether the learning itself causes resilience or if resilient people simply learn more. Additionally, most studies have focused on knowledge workers in developed economies, so we should be cautious about generalizing to blue-collar or gig economy workers, where learning opportunities may be scarcer. Furthermore, most studies measure learning in terms of formal courses, but we live in an age of informal learning. People learn through YouTube tutorials, podcasts, or even social media groups. Capturing that data is nearly impossible, so we might be underestimating the true learning that's happening. Another limitation is the measurement of career resilience. It's often assessed through subjective perceptions, how confident someone feels about handling career changes, rather than objective outcomes. So while the association is positive, we lack rigorous causal evidence. That said, even with these caveats, the practical implications are significant. For individuals, the message is clear: to stay relevant, you must continuously update your skills. That doesn't mean you need to constantly pursue formal degrees. Even short online courses or professional certifications can make a difference. In a survey by LinkedIn, 74% of hiring managers said they value candidates who demonstrate a commitment to learning. But it's not always easy. Time is the biggest barrier reported by learners. Many full-time workers struggle to find those hours for study, alongside their jobs and personal responsibilities. This is a real challenge that needs addressing, perhaps through employer support or more flexible learning options. For employers, the implications are equally profound. Companies that invest in the development of their workforce not only benefit from a more skilled labor pool, but also see higher retention rates. I recall a case of a large retail chain that introduced a program allowing employees to take free coding classes. The result? A 20% reduction in turnover, and many of those employees went on to transition into tech roles within the company. This illustrates a win-win. The employees gained valuable skills, and the company filled talent gaps internally. However, some employers are hesitant, because they fear trained employees will leave for competitors. Yet research suggests that the opposite is true. Employees are more loyal when they feel the company is investing in their growth. So the risk of not training may be higher. Governments and educational institutions also have a role to play. Public policy can encourage lifelong learning through subsidies, tax incentives, or national skills frameworks. For example, Singapore's Skills Future program provides citizens with credits to take approved courses, which has increased adult participation in learning. Universities are expanding their continuing education offerings, with micro-credentials and stackable certificates becoming popular. These flexible pathways allow learners to build qualifications over time without committing to a full degree up front. However, there's a cautionary note: not all credentials are valued equally in the job market. Learners need to be strategic, choosing skills that are in demand and verified by reputable providers. To sum up, lifelong learning isn't just a nice idea, it's a necessity for career resilience in today's volatile economy. The evidence, while imperfect, strongly indicates that continuous skill development enhances employability and adaptability. The challenges, time, access, and the need for quality learning options are real, but not insurmountable. Both individuals and organizations must prioritize learning as a strategic investment. As the philosopher Eric Hoffer once said, In a time of drastic change, it's the learners who inherit the future. Thank you, and I'm happy to take any questions. That's the end of part 4.